Welcome to What is Going Om, for new thought from the edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. Today's show is a special for many reasons. First, because it's being aired throughout the holiday season, which for a significant proportion of the global population is often the most stressful and exhausting period of the year. I'm talking, of course, about those who suffer from anxiety, depression, and mental health issues, and those who love them. Now, if the words mental health make you want to switch off, don't, because the story you're about to hear is one that ultimately shines a much needed light on a subject that's become one of the hottest topics of our era. We all have mental health, just as we all have physical and emotional health. And just as we all struggle to stay in shape or manage our emotions at times, so too will we all face times when our mental health is affected by circumstances beyond our control. The events of this year being the perfect case in point. Another reason this show is special is because it bears news of an exciting new initiative that's dedicated to slaying the dragons of mental health by stripping away the shame, embarrassment, fear, and stigma associated with it. We'll hear more about that later in the show. For now, let's meet author, filmmaker, philanthropist, and mental health advocate Rebecca Shaper, whose book, The Light in His Soul, Lessons from My Brother's Schizophrenia, has been described as essential for anyone who dares to see the miraculous gift that life presents us in our struggles, obstacles, and most difficult moments. Rebecca Shaper, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. I really appreciate it. I'm so thrilled to be here. So excited.
Rebecca, your book, The Light in His Soul, Lessons from My Brother's Schizophrenia, is a story that takes us on a journey through pain, sadness, and suffering of growing up with a mentally ill parent, child sexual abuse, parental suicide, and the 20-year disappearance and reappearance of your much-loved brother, Cor. Tell us a little bit about the family background and the disappearance of your brother, Cor.
Sure. My father was a war hero. He had PTSD. My mother was a debutante. We lived in the South. My mother was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and my brother was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia as well. I also have a younger brother. I grew up with a family of alcoholism, sexual abuse, of course, mental health issues, and both parents died by suicide. My brother had one more semester left in college, and then he took off. He was kind of back and forth. And then in 1977, my mother died by suicide, and that's when Carl left. And we reunited in 1998. Now, think about this. We look like this perfect family, but we weren't.
So did he leave after your mother died or just before your mother died?
After.
After your mother died.
That's when he totally disappeared. When he dropped out of college, there was time in between before my mother died by suicide. But when she committed suicide, he took off.
Was his disappearance a shock to you?
I was not living at home at that time. I was married. And but as time went on, when I knew he wasn't around, I knew something wasn't right. And I went on a search for a very long time trying to find him. But Sandy, I always knew he was alive. I always knew he was alive. Sometimes he would pop in and out, but I could never figure out how to truly bring him back home. Mm. Just, yeah, he wasn't ready.
No. Well, that, you know, search took 20 years.
Yes.
And as you said, sometimes he would call you, yeah, but he would never let you know where he was. But then after 20 years, an incredible synchronicity brought him back into your life. Would you share that with us?
Yes. Whew, this can bring tears to my eyes. I'll never forget that day. I found out later on that he was staying at the Haven of Rest, and they take in homeless people and people who have mental health issues. And that was in Anderson, South Carolina. And I was living in Atlanta, Georgia. They have a thrift store next door, and that's how they were able to help these individuals. So what they would have, the homeless people or the people they were taking in, they would have them go pick up furniture at people's homes. And so Carl and another guy got in the truck. They drove to this person's house. They went in, they picked up the furniture. They went back in the truck. My brother, just by happenstance, looked at the form and it had Shaper on there. He got back out of the truck, walked up to the door, knocked on the door, and he goes, "Marge, do you know who I am? I am Rebecca's brother, Carl Richmond." And Marge goes, "Oh my gosh, Carl, come in. You don't know how happy your sister will be. Let's call her right now." I'll never forget that day because it was 11 o'clock that morning and I got that call and I just, yeah.
Who was Marge?
Good question. Marge is my husband's mother.
Wow. And you had no idea that he was living anywhere near her?
No, I didn't know until later on, until she called me and I went, "Oh my God," he was like, really, he was probably at the Haven of Rest, from what I found out, maybe off and on for 6 years. I had no idea that he was an hour and a half from me.
Oh my God, that's just incredible. So, I mean, did you immediately jump in the car and rush off there?
Yes, I did. I went, okay, I'm flying up there. I went up there. We embraced. It was so surreal. And I'll never forget that day. We were in the parking lot of the Haven of Rest. And we hugged each other. And it was like, here this person, my brother, who I knew was always alive, and he's standing right there in front of me. And it was like I knew him, but I didn't know him, you know. Yeah. But I knew we would build that relationship up. And I saw into his soul. Even though he looked broken, I never felt he was broken inside.
Now, he told you that he'd been diagnosed in that interim. Oh, he'd been diagnosed before with paranoid schizophrenia.
I didn't know until he was with Haven of Rest, and that's okay. When I found out.
Okay.
There was a hospital close by that they were able to get the patients.
So you were able to persuade Carl to come back and live near you?
Well, here's how that unfolded. He stayed there for a little bit until I could find him a place to stay. And I told him, just stay there. I'll find something for you. Well, he kind of ran his course. So I got him a hotel in Greenville, South Carolina, which is 2.5 hours from where I live. And I just told him to stay there. I'll get you help. And so I got him in with the Greenville Mental Health System. And that was a saving grace at that point. He was resistant at first, but then he realized this is what he really needed to do.
But he was glad to be reunited and didn't want to disappear again.
Oh, yeah. No. I remember we were standing on the railroad track and I was filming him. And he said, I said, are you glad to be here? And he goes, oh, yes. He said, I never want to do that again. And I was like, oh, yeah.
Did he ever say why he'd stayed away so long?
No, but you know what? I feel in my heart of hearts, he didn't want to be. Let's see, how can I explain this? I felt like he felt shamed.
Yeah.
I felt like that he was afraid of how other people would treat him. I felt like he'd be judged. And I felt like that he needed to leave to go find whatever it is he needed to find. He lived in the woods a lot. He loved nature just as much as I do.
Now, it wasn't a happy ever after ending by any means. I mean, there were a number of problems. You became his primary caregiver, his supporter, his advocate. But your family, your husband, your children, they weren't exactly overjoyed, were they?
No, I remember when Colin and I first reunited and I told my husband, and my daughters were little at that time. He was afraid. He didn't know how Carl would react. And I had to respect that, even though in my heart, I knew Carl would not do anything to harm anybody, but he did not want Carl in our home. And so we built this trust. And once Carl trusted them and they trusted Carl, we embraced him. He was part of our family. We took him on family vacations. We brought him over for the holiday dinners and we had so much fun. I mean, he was, and my daughters just really embraced him. They saw something special in him.
But there was a time when your daughters felt that you were giving more attention to Carl than to them. And that must have been, you know, very conflicting for you.
Very conflicting. But I knew I had to do what I had to do because he was my brother. I loved him. Mm. And I didn't realize that until a scene in the documentary when they told me how they felt. And it did take me back a little bit.
Yeah, well, you just mentioned a documentary you created while in the 14 years that, you know, Carl was back in your life. You took it upon yourself to create a documentary and log a lot of what was going on as it was occurring. That documentary, A Sister's Call, mm-hmm. is that the title, went on to win a number of awards at various different film festivals. It's really raw and honest, isn't it? I mean, you didn't sugarcoat anything.
You're exactly right. And that was my purpose. I didn't want to sugarcoat anything. And I didn't know anything about filming. I didn't know anything. But when Carl walked into my life, I'll never forget that day. I said, Carl, would you be willing to let me tell a story about your life? And he said, yes, of course. And when he walked away, when I walked away, I'm thinking, wow, that sounded like as though he knew I was going to ask him that. So he was the catalyst. And then everything started unfolding. We started healing the wounds.
What was your original motivation for making that documentary?
To tell his story. That he,
you wanted to tell the world his story.
Yes, that he had a soul. He was a very compassionate person, and he was very loving. And because schizophrenia has this stigma, and I wanted to break that stigma. I said, I want to say something, but I'm not going to. But no, I'm going to show the world that there are very kind, beautiful souls, very creative, very smart, very wise. And so then one thing led to another. I thought it would take a year, but 14 years later.
So really you wanted to take a look at the soul. You wanted us, everybody else in the world, to understand the soul of schizophrenia, not just the diagnosis.
Exactly.
Mm. Exactly. Well, for the next 14 years, I mean, it was not always easy. I mean, he had a number of relapses. What sort of, you know, problems and setbacks did you encounter?
Wow, that's a very good question. Thank goodness I had a social worker who worked with him in Greenville, and we communicated a lot. Sometimes he would be on his medication, and then all of a sudden he'd be okay, and then he felt okay, and then he would not take it anymore. Then he would plummet. And then it was like a roller coaster ride. It was up and down and up and down. And at one point, he was admitted in the Marshall Pickens Hospital for probably 3 or 4 months. And from that point, he really stabilized. He couldn't take care of his apartment that well. But that was okay. I mean, you know, all that stuff, it was him. It was him that I saw. I didn't care about all the, okay, his apartment was a huge mess or whatever. Yes, it was frustrating at times, but it was him that drove me to, I'm kind of loss of words, to expose him that despite all this debris and maybe chaos, he was a beautiful person.
You have hinted in your book that he was psychic, or he had some kind of gift, because he told you something about having heard that your mother mm-hmm. was going to kill herself before she did.
Yeah. I'll never forget this. In the film, we were filming him, and he was reflecting back, and he said, I remember when I was on the road, a voice came over me. He was under the bridge, and he said, a voice came over to me. And the voice said, I'm going to have to take your mother. And 2 weeks later, my mother died by suicide. Now, he was not on medication at all. So is that really... is that hallucination, or was he tapping into something that he was telepathic? I do believe he was telepathic, and there are other stories that.
Did you talk to him about that one? Did you ask him whether, you know, any questions? Do you, you know, where do you think that information came from?
No, because it didn't dawn on me at the time until later on. And during that interview with him, he said, isn't that something? Isn't that really something, knowing that that voice had told him that? He said, I never told Becky, which he called me Becky, and I feel guilty for that. Because mm-hmm. he probably thought I would try to save mom or something. I don't know.
I mean, you said that there, you know, there were times when he relapsed, there were times of chaos when he wasn't looking after his apartment or himself. And, you know, you had to deal with that, obviously. Did you ever feel, you know, that you may have done the wrong thing? Did you ever feel that perhaps you couldn't help him enough?
I never felt like... this was not the right thing. I knew it was. I mean, it was my passion. Some people may have looked at it being obsessive, but no, it was my passion. And I'm sorry, what was the next question that you asked?
Well, I was asking whether you ever really felt, you know, am I fighting a losing battle here? You know, I can't do enough. I can't make him well. It's always going to be like this.
You know, it's a very good question. I came to a point where, why couldn't I strive to get him as high as he could?
Yeah.
But then yet I had to find that balance, and that was hard for me because I didn't want to lose him like I lost my parents. And that was one of the lessons he was teaching me, even though he didn't know it, I knew it. And
say more about that.
Like
lessons that he was teaching you.
Wow. Patience, a lot with patience. I remember him always asking me, Rebecca, how's your patience? How's your patience? And I'm like, well, we're together, right? That should say a lot. I learned that he just loved life. He never complained. He never complained. He lived such a simple life. He didn't have to say much. I learned from that. He didn't have to say it much at all. It was just, he was just an example of being happy where he was, even though he had this diagnosis. And we talk about that in the film, and it's in the book too.
Did he ever, question the diagnosis? I mean, what was his attitude about the diagnosis?
No, I asked him. It's in the film and it's in the book. I said, Carl, how did you feel about this? And he said, I said, what would you tell people about this? He said, I'd tell them to pray and go see a doctor. And we laughed about that. But I said, are you happy? Do you ever regret this? He said, no, not at all. He said, I am so thankful for the people who are around me, who love me.
Now the book is a remarkable book, and it is very heartfelt, very courageous, because I mean, you're exposing your life, your family, because you want the world to know what it is like, you know, to be with somebody in Carl's situation and not see them as broken, to see all the good things in him.
Yes.
There's a wonderful passage in your book that I know you've put aside because you feel it sums up a lot of what you learned from Carl. Would you like to read that to us?
Oh, thank you. I would love to read that. Hold on a second. Sorry. Today, I feel it was the shared pain of abuse that drew Carl and me together in support and healing of each other. It was a powerful underlying subconscious bond. He and I never discussed this, but I felt it was recognized. I'm just gonna tear up. And acknowledged between us. I heard him, I felt him. I would find the best way to help him as I wanted to be helped. And yeah,
Rebecca, I mean, it must be even now, you know, obviously by your responses, your reactions, you tear up. I mean, it is such a poignant and important part of your life and your experience.
Yeah.
And I can't begin to imagine what that is like. But I'm sure there are many people listening who can, who live with the same things that you lived with every single
yes.
day.
Yeah.
And, I think it's important for us to look, as we said earlier, behind the diagnosis and look behind the shame and the stigma and look at the person as a soul.
Yes.
And what they are going through. And you make it quite clear, you know, in the book and in the documentary that, the wonderful parts of us, the way you describe it, is the genuine love, humor, compassion, and deep spirituality are still there, even when hidden by illness. What kept you going? I mean, you know, I know you loved your brother. I know you were passionate about helping him. And with the best will in the world, being a caregiver to somebody in any situation is an extremely debilitating, you know, physically, emotionally. What kept you going?
Wow, that's a loaded question. Passion, love. I can't really articulate it. I just had this driving force. And maybe that was part of the contract that Carl and I had together. I know when Carl and I were together, he would always bring up the word process. So maybe that was part of the process.
What did he mean by process?
I think Carl, you mean what Carl meant by
process? Yeah.
That's a really good question too.
It's an interesting thing for him to say.
Yeah.
He knew there was a process going on.
Yes. And right now we're going through the process.
Yeah.
It's continuing. So to this day, I feel like that he already knew why he was here on this earth, and that he knew our relationship, our contract together, and that he knew that this was part of the process. And during that process with us together, I was still trying to figure out the process. Hope that I'm making sense there. I do remember, I'll tell this little story, when he was in Marshall Pickens, and we were filming at that time, and he talked about the process again. And I said, okay, so you're going through the process. Tell us about the process. And he said, well, I signed this contract. And he said, you wouldn't understand it. It's in the English language, but it's translated differently. He said, you wouldn't understand it. And I said, okay, you know, that's fine. So then I'm sitting there thinking, the contract, our contract, his contract being here, my contract. I mean,
soul contract.
Yeah. And our contract with together, Carl and I, Carl's contract with my family. That's part of the process. It's a complex question, honestly, to answer. And I hope I answered as articulately as I
do remember seeing that in the film. And one of the things that struck me is Carl seemed always to have there was a certain area of calm about him.
Yes.
We didn't see him having rages or getting angry. He seemed patient. He almost seemed amused sometimes. Just, you know, okay. Just,
yes.
You know, I'm chilling. Let everybody else do what they're doing.
Yes, exactly. And here's me. I was buzzing all around, you know, and he would just kind of sit back and he would say, okay, all right, Rebecca. Yeah. I was on this mission and he was just okay. He was going
wonderful sense of humor. You know, and this raises a very interesting point, because in many cultures, people that we might dismiss as having mental health issues are beloved, lauded, praised, looked after, regarded as incredibly gifted. And as a privilege, you know, to the tribe, or they're called shaman. Or if we go back into history, medieval history, Hildegard of Bingen, so many people who were, you know, openly wrote about and spoke about hearing voices and just being ecstatic because God was talking to them. You know, why is it that, you know, some of them we elevate to sainthood and others we put in a mental home?
Yeah, it's horrible. And what has always drawn to me too is, why are they always talking about religion, God? Have you noticed that seems to be a common theme? I may be jumping the gun a little bit here, but I mean, are they really seriously tapping into other dimensions that
we can't see?
Exactly. Yeah. I do believe that. And I do believe that there are mystic voice hearers as well. As a matter of fact, piggyback on that, I'm in the process with another filmmaker doing a documentary about the voices of schizophrenia. And we're exploring that and researching a lot about the mystic voice hearers and more about the voices of schizophrenia.
Well, I'm glad you are, because this is something that needs to be addressed. You know, I'm very encouraged by a lot of the research that's going on right now. There's so much research being done with the microbiome. They know that, you know, certain probiotics, certain microbes in the system will affect mood.
Yes.
We see various things, you know, they're experimenting with psychedelics. Now, I'm not saying that we should give psychedelics to every person who is diagnosed with a mental ailment, but you know, certainly they're showing that a lot of people with depression are actually coming out of depression And it's helping anxiety.
We're on the brink of a whole different field of understanding all of this. And nature, think about nature, how much that meditation, think about that. Yeah. And yes, you're exactly right about the food. The food makes a big difference. And family support, love.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Well, there are many elements to your story and we really can't cover all of them, but what are the key lessons that you learned from your experience that could help others?
Compassion, trust, to give others hope. Don't give up. I know it can be very difficult at times, but don't give up. There's something to be learned by it all. And you never know what that could be. And the people that are taking care of the individual who have mental health issues, be sure to take care of yourself. That's so important. The caregiver, please take care of yourself. And I feel like this is the process right here to help others, to give others hope and not give up.
Now, we talked a little bit about your children feeling left out, overlooked. You know, mummy doesn't love us. She loves Uncle Cole. That must happen in every family. We know that, when somebody's sick in a family, all the attention goes to that person. The siblings often feel overlooked, pushed aside. Yeah. What sort of, and there's two things going on here. What advice would you give to people who are caregiving, you know, the one who isn't well at the expense of the ones that are? Because it's not always easy to see it yourself, is it?
Are you saying, all right, I'm sorry, can you rephrase that again?
If
at one point,
let's say I'm looking after somebody who's ill and I'm putting all my attention on them and supporting them, it's easy to overlook the other members of my family. What advice would you offer someone in that position so that they can, you know, be mindful of the need to take care of others?
That's what it's very important to look out after the others as well, because they're affected very much.
And what about, you know, your children? I mean, what would you say to the siblings and the watchers and the ones that are being pushed aside? You know, what advice would you give them so that they understand that better?
I know this is very difficult for you. And I understand that we're putting a lot of attention on this individual right now. We love you, but pay attention to their behavior. Pay attention to what, if they're isolating, just pay attention, because it does affect other siblings. And I cannot emphasize enough to make sure you bring that sibling or whoever it is that's not getting the attention, try your best to give them as much love. But in the same token, watch out. Just watch out, because things could happen. They could be resentful.
Now, your family did obviously come to love Cole and support him. Mm-hmm. But still, 14 years is a long time. And you did have to spend a lot of time driving back and forth and spending time with Cole and resolving whatever issues occurred. That must have taken a toll, with your children and with your husband. How did you bridge that one? How did you navigate, that conflict there where, you couldn't be in two places at one time?
I needed to do what I had to do it. I don't want to say I had to do it. I wanted to do it. And during that time, my daughter Kim was going through a lot of stuff, my older daughter. And I knew she would get better. And I knew that my brother would get better. That was it for me. I just knew they would get better. And I would do.
How do you define call getting better? What were you expecting or hoping to see?
At the end, he was stabilized. He stopped smoking. He stopped drinking. He was back to his old self. He was engaging in family activities. He was socializing. We'd go in the stores and people would just gravitate him to him. He was like this gentle giant. Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
I was going to say, your father also committed suicide. Did he commit suicide before Call came back or after?
He died by suicide in 1988. He shot himself in the heart in the shower. And he left a suicide note. And the last sentence in that suicide note was, Call never said I was happy anyway. So to me, that said a lot, because Call and my brother had a very volatile, Call and my father had a very volatile relationship. But Call, I observed, Call saw into my father. And in some way, I don't want to say healed, but I can't quite articulate the word, but it was like an underlying support that my brother had for Call. Maybe that's not the right word, but my father, he was a very unhappy individual. And I think my brother saw into that and tried to make him happy.
Mm-hmm. When your father died, mm-hmm. was that was while Call was gone. Mm-hmm. Did Call know about that?
Oh, good question. No, he was on the road. And I had no idea how to contact him. No idea. And this is just really bizarre. He called Collect. That's when we didn't have cell phones. He called Collect. And he said, Becky, I'm trying to get a hold of Dad. Where is he? He was in St. Louis and I was still living in Atlanta. I said, Call, Dad is dead. You need to come home. So we got him a bus ticket and he came home. And that's how he found out. My father passed away in July, and it was not until October until Carl found out.
How long did he stay with you?
Not long.
Not long. What was his reaction to your father dying in that manner?
Oh, that's a good question. Wow. I don't know. I don't remember.
He never talked about suicide in relation to your parents?
Oh, wait a minute. Are you talking about how... What question?
What was Call's response to your father committing suicide, like your mother had done?
Nothing. I mean, I honestly, I don't remember. It was just such a blur. Yeah. It was such a blur. And to be honest, I don't remember. But I didn't tell my brother until after my father died that my father sexually abused me. And that's when he just went, he was shocked.
Wow. When you watch the movie that you made, mm-hmm. you know, which shows your family all together at certain points around the table discussing their feelings about, you know, Call coming back into their lives and, you know, real-time events between you and Call as well. What do you think? What do you feel? Do you feel that, do you wish that you'd done something different, better, more?
No.
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 You don't feel guilty.
In my heart of hearts, I felt like I did everything I possibly could, not only to my brother, but to my daughter, Kim, and my other daughter, Lauren. But you never know until later on the side effects.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because when you're so immersed in it, sometimes it's hard to really step out and be objective, to really observe.
So did you feel, you know, how did Cole himself pass?
With colon cancer. I'll never forget this. And again, I think this was something telepathic that both of us had. In March of 2012, something kept gnawing at me that I should call him or go see him. But I was too busy doing stuff with the documentary and on the roads, doing film festivals, whatever. And I never did until I think we had him down here in July of 2012. And that's when we found out that he had colon cancer. And he lived till September. And I took him to the doctor, and he had edema. It was, he was just full of edema. And I took him to the doctor hoping, quote, that he could survive this. But he looked at the doctor when the doctor told him that he had colon cancer stage 4. And the doctor goes, I'm sorry, you know, you've got this amount of time to live. And my brother reached over and shook the doctor's hand, and he said, thank you for your wisdom. I mean, there's another lesson. It's like, wow, he's embracing death.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah.
So how long was it after getting the diagnosis that he passed? Was it a short period of time?
Yeah. Yeah. And he passed in September. We found out in July of 2012, he passed away September 4th, 2012. But yeah, it was very sacred. He was in hospice, and the girls and I would go and visit him. Jim would go visit him. And so many synchronicities led up to it all. It was pretty amazing. I felt like angels were around him. And that's one thing that Carl did tell me. He said when he was young, he saw it. And when he was laying in his bed, he said, Rebecca, I saw an angel. And I think that's what helped him through everything. But getting back to his death, it was very sacred, extremely sacred. We played, my daughter, Lauren, put plugs in his ear so he could listen to his favorite music as he was slowly but surely passing away. And when he finally passed, you know, we all gave him a big hug and whatever. And then I had to take a picture of both of us. And I know what he was probably thinking after he passed his way. Okay, Rebecca, you know, here we go again, but I'm going to give it to you one more time. So at that time I had a cell phone and I leaned up against him and I took a picture. It didn't work. Third time, it finally worked, and it's such a beautiful picture of both of us together.
How did he respond to you writing a book about him and his life and doing a documentary?
The documentary, he was all about it. Now, when the book came, it was 2015, because I thought I was done after the documentary. I said, you know, I'm done. And then this... I just felt this tug, this voice inside me. No, you're not, Rebecca. Yeah, there's more to the story, which is good because it goes more in depth, which I couldn't say in the film. And so Carl had already passed at that time.
And when he did pass, did you feel a form of peace that you had found him, you had made his life different, you had done all of the things that you wanted to do, and you could close the book with a clear conscience and with love?
Yes, but it was, you know, it took a while. You know, and he's still around us. I feel him, especially my daughter, Lauren. He shows, I mean, he shows up music. He shows, I mean, there's so much more I could talk about, but he's still around us. I know he's, Phil, he's right here.
Yeah. Now, you're very open to the, you know, the spiritual aspect of everybody, not just Cole. And it must be hard for people who don't have that belief system to deal with some of it, you know, because it feels like a punishment, I imagine, or I don't know. I mean, who am I to say? Is there any advice that you could give to somebody who's struggling with caring for somebody who has this diagnosis, or somebody who's struggling, you know, because they've got a diagnosis like this?
Yeah. Don't be hard on yourself. Be compassionate. Have compassion. Listen to that individual. Listen to what they're saying. Tell them that you hear them and you see them. And have faith and trust. Don't give up. There's hope. And I hope that this podcast will help others.
What advice would you give to someone who cannot tell reality from hallucination? How do you deal with that, you know, in real time, if you're with someone who's having that challenge? I mean, what is reality? We don't know ourselves.
But yeah. That's kind of a tough question to answer.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. I can only kind of go through my own experience with Carl. I knew when there were times when he definitely was not making a lot of sense. I mean, just use your common sense. You would know. If you know that person well enough, you'll know whether if they're dealing with reality or not. I hope that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I really don't have that's the best way I can explain it. That's a real tough question.
You, since the documentary and the book, you've put a lot of effort, a lot of time, a lot of money into being an advocate for mental health. You speak at various different events. Tell us a little bit about what you've been doing since then.
Well, I've been on podcasts as well. This other documentary that I'm working on, you and I doing this together, which I'm forever grateful for. And just whenever I have an opportunity or speak to someone about it, I share experiences. We share experiences.
You've also done an awful lot of research yourself, haven't you? So yes. You can speak quite knowledgeably.
Yes.
To this
yes.
topic.
Yes. And, we're finding out more, but I don't want to reveal that right now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you just gave something away that we alluded to earlier. At the beginning of tonight's show, I did speak about a new project dedicated to slaying the dragons of mental health by stripping away the shame, the embarrassment, the fear, and the stigma associated with it. Now, why a new project? Well, as mentioned, mental health isn't something that's applicable to just some of us. It applies to all of us. It's part of the human condition. And when I read Rebecca's book and watched her documentary, it moved me greatly. And we both are of the same mind that no person ever should be made to feel embarrassed, ashamed, or be discriminated against for simply being human. So tonight you've heard just one person's story. All over the world, millions of people are living their own stories and millions of people are looking for answers. And long before COVID and lockdowns became part of our language, mental health statistics were climbing. Since then, experts are all in agreement that we're heading toward a worldwide crisis. No one knows for sure what causes mental health issues. Myriad things can tip the scales of our emotional, physical, psychological, and our mental equilibrium, from brain and body chemistry, hormones, food, nutrition, trauma, shock, our microbiome, to pharmaceutical drugs, psychedelic substances, meditation, visionary experiences, and spiritual awakenings. But Rebecca Shaper and I want to find out We want to do whatever we can to find some answers for people. So we're going to join forces, and starting in January 2021, we're launching a new live video and audio podcast dedicated to demystifying, destigmatizing, humanizing, and personalizing mental health. This show is going to air at noon, Eastern Time, on the first and the third Thursdays of every month. It's called Cracked, the podcast, and its goal is to expand the conversation about mental health. So we are leaving no stone unturned, no question unasked, and no potential solution unexamined in our quest to shine many different lights on a topic that none of us can afford to ignore. Crack the podcast is going to explore them all, including and perhaps especially something that Rebecca has touched upon in this interview, and that's the notion that for many, a breakdown can be the beginning of a breakthrough. For as the poet and philosopher Leonard Cohen observed, there is a crack in everything. It's where the light gets in. Rebecca, no one can doubt the passion that you have for taking the shame out of mental health issues. Before we bring this show to an end, I would like you to tell us what you hope to achieve with this podcast.
Oh, that's a beautiful question. First of all, I just want to say thank you very much, and I'm so grateful for this. To give others hope. Everybody has a soul. Look into that soul, no matter what it is that's going on. I feel like we're on the brink of really understanding what the mental health issue is all about. And have trust and faith in yourself and in others. Just don't give up and ask for help. If you need it, ask for help. Don't be ashamed. Don't be ashamed. And you're loved.
Yeah, and don't be ashamed to offer help to someone else who's suffering. I mean, we do tend to shy away from things we don't understand.
Exactly.
That's a natural human, reaction, I think. And why do we do that? You know, the thing that I've learned through talking to you, through watching your documentary, reading your book, and doing some research for this future podcast is that, mental health is the same for all of us as physical health, as emotional health. It's not something any of us can avoid. As I said at the beginning, it is something that, we all are going to find moves up and down the scale, different times, lost grief. Betrayal, divorce, losing our job, goodness gracious, suffering through the past, year with the lockdown and all of the fears that have gone along with that, fears of catching, a virus, fears of losing one's job, fears for one's family. The statistics are just rocketing. And I think that, humans are fragile beings. And anything. I mean, even going through the menopause, women will often say they feel like they're going crazy. So anything can tip those scales a little bit one way or the other. So it's not something we can ignore because it is something that is in our lives. It's there in front of us everywhere we look. It's in our families. It's in ourselves.
And don't be afraid to look at it because there's something to learn from it.
Yeah.
And there's a gift there. Yes. Yeah.
So, any last words of wisdom, Rebecca?
I hope I said enough, and I just hope that people will resonate with this and be excited about this, because you and I have a very strong passion for this, and we want to educate so many people, and there'll be resources also as well that people...
Yeah. It's important to say that anyone who's listening who... is dealing with mental health issues or knows somebody they love. We do hope to create this podcast as a resource We want to expose and shine the light on every single nook and cranny, every single possibility, and provide as many resources as we can. You know, I'm based in England, Rebecca's in America, and this is an international podcast that can be heard all over the world. So, you know, there's no such thing as boundaries or barriers.
And mental health is a worldwide situation, condition.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Rebecca Shaper, thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing your story. And thank you for embarking on this new venture with me.
Oh, I'm so excited, Sandy. Can't wait.
Me
neither. Thank you very much.
That's it for tonight. We hope you'll join us for the inaugural edition of Crack the Podcast on Thursday, January the 7th, 12 noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific and 6 p.m. UTC. In the meantime, I'll be back next week with another edition of What is Going On. Till then, it's goodbye from me.